Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 2nd, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, changing chimpanzee research, how herpes can repeatedly reinfect, and a better understanding of the Earth's evolution. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about tiny bubbles in the ocean from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It's been 50 years since Jane Goodall first studied chimpanzees in Tanzania. Since then, scientists have created a lot more tools to study them, including DNA analysis, global positioning systems, even video cameras. In a package of stories in this week's Science, contributing correspondent John Cohen reports on how that's changed chimpanzee research and what it's telling us about ourselves and our closest relatives.
The easy, low-hanging fruit had been picked already. I mean, when Goodall went to the field, no one had ever really done studies of wild chimps methodically, and captive chimps had been studied for many years, but there really wasn't much of a field. So everything really starts around 1960. And the more subtle questions are what people are addressing now. I mean, yes, chimps use tools. We know that. But do they use the same tools everywhere? No, they don't. And so that leads to questions about chimpanzee culture and how it differs from place to place. And that's the level of sophistication that is occurring today that wasn't there 50 years ago.
Why is it so much more important to study chimps in the wild than to study them in captivity?
I don't think it is more important to study them in the wild. I think both offer information about chimpanzees. And what's happening now more than ever is people are blending the two. It used to be that you did one or the other, but now there are several researchers that do both. Chimp cognition, for example, the chimp mind is the chimp mind, whether the chimp is in the wild or in captivity. In captivity, you can conduct experiments with touchscreen computers that you can't do in the wild. But in the wild, people are now starting to do playback experiments where they record their vocalizations and then play them back to see how chimps react, and that gives a window into their minds.
Isn't there some concern, though, with researchers having so much power over chimps that these experiments in the lab aren't going to really reveal very much?
Not really. I mean, the question in laboratory experiments is, are they reproducible? With a lot of chimp research of the past, nobody could ever reproduce anything, so you couldn't build on it. But today, people are much more careful and methodical about how they do things, and they can repeat the experiments again and again and prove that things are really what they say.
Let's talk a little bit about chimp culture, which you mentioned earlier. What in particular are researchers learning about this?
It's interesting that chimpanzees that live in communities that abut each other may do very different things. Let's say one group grooms each other by holding their hands up above their heads, and another group does it a different way. Maybe one group cracks open nuts and eats them, where a community next door that also has the same nuts doesn't eat them and doesn't crack them. So there are profound differences in these behaviors that appear to be transmitted from generation to generation in a given community.
So another instance of where something that was thought to separate humans from the rest of the animal kingdom doesn't seem to be so separating.
That's the heart of the question. I think that people are fascinated by chimps in particular because they are our closest relatives along with bonobos, and they tell us what it means to be human and where the dividing line is that actually separates humans from chimps. Yes, they have culture, but it is nothing like human culture. And then you come down to a real fine honed definition of, okay, well, what makes us human? And you can only see it by understanding what they can and can't do.
Are there things that chimps can do besides the physical abilities that they have that we can't as humans? Any cognitive?
Yeah, there's a remarkable study being done in Japan with chimpanzees that have been trained to recognize Arabic numerals in order. And then they masked the numbers in hundreds of milliseconds. And the chimps can remember 1 through 6 at 200th of a millisecond. We can't do that. So their short-term memory in that experiment is beyond anything humans can do. We are not better than them in every way. That's one of the great myths about humans and chimps. It's a balancing act. There are some things they do better. There are some things we do better.
As we learn more and discover that they are much more like us than perhaps we thought previously, are there any growing ethical concerns that might limit future research in chimpanzees?
Well, I'm going to question your premise. Sorry. I'm not arguing that we're learning that they're closer to us than we thought before. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Okay.
In fact, I think what we're realizing is that we have emphasized similarities for many, many years, and that it's really in the differences that we start to see what makes us human. And that this collection of articles is not a polemic in any sense. I'm not making an argument, but I think there's abundant evidence that the differences are where the field is moving toward. That's what's really fascinating. Yes, of course we are similar. That point has been made. We know that now. Now let's really focus in on those dividing lines. Are there ethical concerns? Yes, the chimpanzee populations are diminishing in the wild, and chimps in captivity are dwindling in number, in part because of ethical concerns about conducting certain types of experiments that people no longer feel are justified, that actually cause harm to chimps. So a lot of research piggybacked on biomedical research that it has fallen out of favor.
So are people who are studying captive chimps in particular, are they concerned?
They're very worried because the calculations are that in about 20 years, there will no longer be chimps available for research in captivity. And the U.S. has the largest population. There are about 1,000 so-called research chimps, and they're not breeding any longer for the most part. The U.S. National Institutes of Health stopped funding the breeding of new chimps in 1995, and it hasn't resumed yet, and they have a moratorium on it. It won't. So centers that own chimpanzees can pay for it themselves, but it's incredibly expensive to house a chimpanzee properly for 40 or 50 years. You can no longer bring in chimpanzees from the wild into captivity. That's illegal now by international convention. 30 years ago, you could do that, but that doesn't happen now. So they have to be bred if they're going to sustain these colonies. And it looks to most researchers at the front like they can't be sustained. It cannot happen.
So it sounds as if the research field is going to head towards going back to the wild and studying more wild populations.
Yes, and that window is closing too, because wild populations are being decimated by their habitats being destroyed and by the bushmeat trade and by people taking chimps as pets. So those numbers are dwindling too. It's pretty bleak.
It sounds like it. Do funding opportunities now include conservation funds?
They do, and that's one of the major dramatic shifts that's occurred. Researchers today basically are all conservationists. That's part of their job. If you study wild chimps, you have to be protecting them at the same time. And that is, in large part, the legacy of Jane Goodall. She made the world aware of how fragile the chimp populations were and are. And so researchers today, a lot of them get into the business to do conservation. They start as researchers, but they quickly move into a conservation role.
John Cohen, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Science contributing correspondent John Cohen reports on the changes to chimpanzee research. Find the whole package of stories, 14 pages in all, in this week's issue. U.S. federal courts recently issued two decisions, both related to patents, that could have major implications for scientific research and development. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit upheld a ruling in Ariad Pharmaceuticals versus Eli Lilly and Company that may make it more difficult for scientists and engineers, particularly those at academic institutions, to patent their basic research. The 9-2 decision stated that patents are not awarded for academic theories, no matter how groundbreaking or necessary to the later patentable inventions of others. The decision noted that patent law has always been directed to inventions of a practical use. Well aware of potential effects of its decision, the court wrote, "Universities may not have the resources or the inclination to work out the practical implications of their research, which could disadvantage them when seeking patents." A second case, meanwhile, could cast doubt on the validity of gene patents if the decision is not overturned, though appeal is likely. On Monday, a federal judge struck down patents on two genes linked to breast and ovarian cancer. A group led by the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, challenged the patents with a lawsuit in May. The group argued that genes, as products of nature, are not patentable, and that gene patents stifle outside research and limit patient choice when it comes to genetic tests. Myriad Genetics, the company that holds the patents at the heart of the case, argued that the work of isolating DNA transforms it and renders it patentable. The judge agreed with ACLU, putting a question mark on all gene patents, which cover roughly 20% of human genes.
That was Policy Form Editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. When you get infected with a virus like influenza, your body's adaptive immune system clears the infection and, in a sense, remembers, so that if you encounter the same virus, or one very similar to it, you won't get sick again. But there are some viruses, like herpes virus, that confound the immune system, flaring up and reactivating by infection from the same or similar strain of herpes virus, even though the body has seen it before. In a paper in this week's Science, Lewis Picker, Klaus Frue, and colleagues report how one herpes virus, called cytomegalovirus, continues to reinfect human hosts despite the body's capacity to control the initial infection. The research suggests new ways of creating viral vectors to induce immune responses against other pathogens, such as human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. I spoke with Picker and Frue from their offices at the Oregon Health and Science University. Here's Klaus Frue.
For some viruses, and maybe other pathogens as well, it's going to be very difficult to develop a vaccine that protects against infection. And what we found is that this particular virus, CMV, cytomegalovirus, is extremely efficient in overcoming a tremendous immune response. Basically, when you're infected already with this virus, and you're going to be infected for all your life, and this virus drives your immune system crazy. Basically, 10%, 20% of your T cells, these are the killer cells in your body, are directed to this virus. Nevertheless, you can go in and with as little as 100 viruses, you can reinfect an animal. And we assume, because there are clinical data out there, that the same is happening in humans. So although your immune system is wonderfully primed and very specific, the virus has found ways around it, and we've now figured out why the virus can do this.
Lewis, what kind of disease is cytomegalovirus?
Well, cytomegalovirus is a member of the herpes family of viruses, but it's its own special virus that goes way back in mammalian evolution, and we've basically evolved with this virus as almost a symbiote or a parasite. And actually, in the great majority of people, and most people on Earth will be infected by this virus, the great majority of people will get it and never know they've had it. Only in very special circumstances does it cause disease, act as a pathogen. One of those circumstances is if you have this virus and you get a bone marrow transplant or get significant immunosuppression, it will come out and cause the disease. If you get AIDS, at the end stage of AIDS, it will cause disease. And finally, if you happen to get your first infection during pregnancy, if a pregnant woman gets infected, the virus can be transmitted to the fetus, which is also immunodeficient, relatively, because of immaturity, and that fetus can get infected, and that infection can cause birth defects. So the disease is actually quite rare, but nevertheless quite significant clinically.
And Lewis, how does it spread?
It spreads mostly from oral secretions or can be secreted in spit and in urine, and basically it spreads by the same way other viruses are spread, by getting the materials that are infected on mucous membrane. And it's very common to get during preschool, obviously. There's lots of secretions that are shared by preschool kids, and that's when in Western countries most kids get it, and also in adolescence is the second sort of wave of getting this virus.
So were you and your team then using human cytomegalovirus in macaques, Klaus?
No, the reason to do the study in macaques is actually that human CMV cannot infect animals, at least not animals that have an immune system. And so what researchers do is they study the cytomegalovirus of each species. As it turns out, cytomegalovirus has co-evolved with us. You know, there is cytomegalovirus in every single mammal that has been looked at. And in fact, if you compare the genomes of the cytomegaloviruses that infect a particular species, primate cytomegalovirus is more closely related to human cytomegalovirus than rodent cytomegalovirus, which is another widely studied model. And so these molecules I've been studying, these molecules that inhibit antigen presentation in human cytomegalovirus, they are not conserved in rodent cytomegalovirus, but they are there in rhesus cytomegalovirus. And so the reason to do these studies in macaques was this is the closest model that we can use because the virus is most closely related to human CMV of any model that's out there, other than chimpanzees. But chimpanzees are, of course, protected species and not practically used in this kind of studies.
It's actually probably one of the most efficient viruses in terms of its ability to reinfect, if not the most efficient virus in terms of its ability to reinfect an immune host. And, you know, this puzzled us how this could possibly be. And Klaus had the idea that it could be these particular genes that mediate T-cell evasion, and that's what started the study. It turns out that these genes, in fact, were responsible for this ability to mediate superinfection. But what was remarkable was that they were not necessary for primary infection. And, of course, during primary infection, an immune response develops over time. But still, these genes were not, the virus could still be maintained in the body, even if it didn't have these genes, if it were infected into a naive host, a host that didn't have an immune response. It was only to escape in that initial infection, these genes were only necessary to escape the immune response in the very early days or weeks of infection. And that was a surprise.
More precisely, what mechanism did you and your team find that explains this persistent reinfection or superinfection of cytomegalovirus in rhesus macaques?
So it turns out,
Klaus,
and that has been known for a while, that cytomegalovirus has several genes that prevent antigen presentation. So what is antigen presentation? When the cell gets infected with a virus, there is no way for the immune system to know that this cell is infected. Normally, there wouldn't be a way because it's inside the cell. It's beyond the cell membrane. But what we have are molecules called natural histocompatibility molecules. And what they do is they take up little snippets, so-called peptides or little fragments from proteins from the virus and transport them to the cell surface. And so now you have basically a whole universe of viral fragments being at the cell surface at display. And that is what the T cells see. And that activates T cells. And then they will kill these cells, infected cells, and thereby saving the tissue. So that's how it theoretically should work. Now, cytomegalovirus and many other viruses have found ways to block this from happening, which means that the cell can be infected with the virus, yet this infection remains invisible to the immune system. So that was known in tissue culture, that cytomegalovirus inhibits this antigen presentation and thereby also inhibits the activation of T cells. But what's not known was what is this good for in the real world, in animals, in humans. And so what we found is that if we take out the genes from the virus that do this, so now the virus can no longer inhibit this display of antigens, then what happens is that the T cells that are in the body of the animals that are already infected with CMV, these T cells now are able to prevent the virus from getting another foothold in the animal. So in other words, now the virus is exposed to the immune system, and then the immune system is able to do its job, which means to eliminate the virus. And what was so interesting about the study is that this was an all-or-nothing effect. If the virus cannot inhibit antigen presentation, there's absolutely no way, even if we go in with 10 million viruses into the animals, the virus does absolutely nothing. There's no sign that the virus lacking these molecules was able to superinfect these animals.
On the other hand,
Lewis,
if you took away the CD8 T cells at the same time you superinfected these already immune animals, then the virus would go in. And then the T cells would come back after a few weeks, and even still, at that point, the virus could not be eliminated. So there is a checkpoint, a T cell mediated checkpoint, very early in infection where the virus that doesn't have these genes is susceptible to complete elimination. Unfortunately, the viruses that circulate out in the real world all have these genes. And so the implication is that they're able to evade at this checkpoint. And therefore, if you try to make a vaccine, a T-cell vaccine in particular, that would prevent infection, you would be unable to do so because the natural viruses have these genes which would allow them to evade this checkpoint which we described. But in fact, there's another side of a coin that we should talk about, and that is that when one is making vaccines against other pathogens, let's say tuberculosis or HIV, one often uses viral vectors. That means you take a virus and you adapt it and design it to carry proteins or genes encoding proteins of another virus and use that virus to generate immunity against that other pathogen. So a so-called viral vector as part of a vaccine. What this ability to superinfect actually makes CMV into potentially a very useful viral vector, since viral vectors are usually inhibited by having an immune response against them. And so if you have a person that's already seen the virus that the vector is derived from, then that vector won't work. But with CMV, that's not an issue because it can superinfect. So potentially we can exploit this ability to superinfect by designing CMV vectors, that is CMV that are safe, that are prevented by genetic manipulation from causing disease, but can still reinfect and induce immune responses against other pathogens. And we have a very active program trying to adapt and develop CMV vectors for HIV, for example.
Right. So now what we're trying to find is other genes in the genome of the virus.
Klaus?
That if we take them out, will make the virus attenuated so that it can no longer cause any disease, even in situations where the immune system is not functioning, like in the fetus, in AIDS patients, etc. And so that's going to be the next step here.
Louis Picker and Klaus Fruh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right.
Louis Picker and Klaus Fruh of the Oregon Health and Science University are corresponding authors of a paper on the mechanism behind superinfecting cytomegalovirus. Find the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Compared to the seafloor, land doesn't change that much. But under the oceans, the Earth's mantle is continually pushing magma up through the oceanic crust at the boundary between tectonic plates, forming long mountain-sized ridges as it cools and spreading the sea floor. And as Claudia Adam and Valerie Vidal report in a paper in this week's Science, the direction of mantle flow beneath the cooler, solid oceanic lithosphere continues to affect the depth of the seafloor as it spreads, thickens, and gradually sinks, or subsides. That result, a change from the assumptions of previous models, clears up a long-standing mystery in plate tectonics and provides a new perspective on mantle heat flow and how ocean basins evolve. I spoke with Adam from her home in France. Adam is a researcher with the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology and the University of Évora in Portugal.
So we have a mantle, a convecting mantle, and the upper layer of this mantle is the solid lithosphere. And until now, the lithosphere was considered from a static point of view. That means that it was considered as a passive cooling after its formation of mid-oceanic ridges, so where plates diverge. And what we showed here is that the lithosphere should be considered from a dynamic point of view. That means that it's a constant interaction with the underlying mantle convection. So that will be the main point of our paper, actually. Geodynamics, geophysics should be considered from a dynamic point of view.
What was the evidence against the static point of view of the mantle?
So, yeah, there was some problem with this hypothesis because from a static point of view, the depth of the lithosphere was considered as a function of age because from the static point of view, we consider its cooling from the formation at the ridge, but basically for age greater than 70 million years, we observe a flattening. That means the seafloor depth is always greater than the one predicted by the model. And many people have tried to explain this departure. And basically, it's explained by additional heat at the base of the lithosphere. And many hypotheses have been put forward to explain this flattening, but there's no consensus on the origin of this heat supply. And actually, there's no physical reason to have this heat supply all over the plate. So the model was not perfect, the static model. So looking at the seafloor depth as a function of the age of the seafloor depth, there were some problems with it. We couldn't explain everything from this point of view.
So if I could summarize, just to make sure I understand, the ridge is where the new mantle is coming up, where the volcanism is happening.
At the ridge we have a mantle upwelling.
And then
it is driven away to subduction zone.
Okay.
It forms the lithosphere.
And as it's cooling, it's sinking.
As it's cooling, so it cools, it thickens, and it sinks.
But there was some problem because for parts of the lithosphere that were older than 70 million years old, it wasn't sinking anymore. It appeared to be
flattening. It was flattening, yes. It was sinking a bit, but not as much as the model, conductive model, would predict.
Okay. And so what led you and your co-author to consider this alternative view, that it's not the age of the ocean floor that determines the depth, but distance from the oceanic ridge along the mantle flow?
Mm-hmm. So from a geodynamic point of view, the lithosphere is also the thermal boundary layer of the mantle convection. So if so, it should be considered along directions which are representative of this mantle convection. And these directions are called flow lines. And we consider the pathymetry along these flow lines. And in this case, we have a linear relationship between the depth of oceanic seafloor and the distance to the ridge all along the plate. So actually, along flow lines, the conductive model works. So the cooling of a half space model could explain all the bathymetry all along the plate without invoking any heat supply.
And which part of the ocean floor did you and your co-author examine?
So we studied all the oceanic plates. So we analyzed more than 770 profiles, which lead to a complete coverage of the Pacific plate. And along all this trajectory, we have a linear relationship between ocean seafloor depth and square root of the distance.
Would you expect this hypothesis also to be valid for the Atlantic?
Well, actually, we studied the Atlantic as well. We just published the Pacific. In the Atlantic, there are some other problems. The main problem being that the flow lines representative of mantle convection are very close to edge trajectories. So this hypothesis cannot be really tested on the Atlantic. But still, by looking at the Atlantic on both sides of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, we see some departure from the linear trend, but still there's no flattening. So most of the time, the departure are due to the influence of continents because there are passive margins on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. And in some places, the linear relation still holds true. And the departure is not only flattening. So usually people say that it's the departure from the conductive model, it's flattening, so a supply of heat. But what we observe in the Atlantic is either a flattening or a dipping. So these, for me, are the influence of continents. So we're trying to quantify this influence for the moment.
Claudia Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Claudia Adam of the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology and the University of Evora is lead author of a paper on how mantle flow drives the subsidence of oceanic plates. Find the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Finally today, David Graham, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about tiny bubbles in the ocean. What are those tiny bubbles doing there, Dave?
Well, Rob, these tiny bubbles, also known as microbubbles, would actually be reflecting sunlight to help cool the planet.
This is a geoengineering idea, then.
Exactly. This is all part of this burgeoning field called geoengineering, which is basically attempts by researchers to devise strategies that would help curb global warming. The idea being the world is heating up. Is there anything we can do as humans to help reverse that trend? And there's been a number of pretty wild schemes proposed. Researchers have proposed everything from launching mirrors into space to help block the sun to seeding the oceans with iron, which would actually increase the population of algae that eat CO2. And the more CO2 you remove from the atmosphere, ostensibly the cooler the world would become. And this latest idea is also pretty wacky. It involves pumping zillions of these microbubbles into the ocean. And it turns out these bubbles are actually very reflective.
The bubbles are just bubbles of air?
They're just bubbles of air, but they actually act almost like mirrors when they get to that really tiny size. And this researcher has proposed that by pumping enough of these bubbles into the ocean, you could actually reflect a significant amount of sunlight. He's actually shown via simulations that you could actually double the reflectivity of water at a concentration of only about one part per million by volume of these bubbles. And when he plugged this into some climate simulations, he found that best case scenario, you could actually reduce the temperature of the planet by up to 3 degrees Celsius, which is actually a pretty huge amount.
Is there something about these microbubbles that would keep them from popping? I mean, it seems like you'd just shove these bubbles down into the ocean and then they would just rise up and disappear.
Well, that's actually what the research says is the biggest stumbling point for this idea. It's actually not the amount of energy that would be needed to create these bubbles. He actually envisions devices that could actually be hung off the side of boats that would mix water with compressed air to create the bubbles. He says that part is actually pretty technically feasible and low cost in energy. What's less feasible is what you refer to, Rob, is this whole idea of the bubbles popping. It turns out that actually is a huge issue. And actually, in nature, a bubble's lifetime depends on the level of dissolved organic matter and nanoparticles in the bubble. So the less of this you have, the shorter the lifetime of the bubble. So if the water is too clean, the bubbles might not last long enough to be effectively spread over large areas and to affect these reductions in Earth's temperature.
What's the potential effect on the ecosystem?
Well, that's a really good question, and not something we got into in our article, but if you look through the comments, this is a concern that a lot of readers have had. You know, what's going to be the effect on fish if you've got all these bubbles in the ocean? Is it really a good idea to start mucking with the ocean or even the temperature of the planet? We've sort of shown that we can do damage the other way by contributing to greenhouse gases. But do we necessarily know enough about how all of these very complex ecosystems work to go in and start mucking with them? That's the really big question here.
So more computer simulations to follow, it sounds like.
Probably.
All right. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of controversial ideas, this next story is about another controversial idea, this one involving animal behavior. And the idea is why do we learn socially from each other? You know, humans and a lot of other animals live in these very big groups. And part of the reason scientists say that these societies, whether they be humans or non-human primates or even rodents, part of the reason these big societies can work is because animals learn from each other. They learn how to forage for food or just the art of communal living. And because of that, researchers have said only animals that live in these big groups, these big social groups, are capable of social learning. In other words, only these animals are capable of looking at, say, what another animal is doing and learning something maybe about a better way to hunt or a better way to find food or, you know, even a better place to sleep. But there's a new study that challenges this notion. It's a study with pretty much what you would consider the complete opposite of a social group. It involves red-footed tortoises. And red-footed tortoises are about as antisocial as it gets. As soon as they're born, they're alone. Their parents are already gone. Their siblings are gone. And they basically wander the earth or they wander their home range by themselves. Occasionally, they'll run into a turtle of the opposite sex and sort of have a perfunctory mating session.
I was wondering when you were going to say that.
But then everybody goes their own ways. And so, again, it's hard to think of a sort of a more antisocial animal than the red-footed tortoise. But in this new study, researchers observed a really interesting behavior that smacked of social learning. A researcher saw that when she had a couple of these turtles in captivity, one of them seemed to be carefully observing the other turtle when this other turtle foraged for food. And the researcher said, I wonder if, you know, these turtles are somehow learning from each other about maybe the best place to grab a snack. What she did is she set up this experiment where she created a V-shaped fence. And on the inside of the V, she put a bowl of strawberry and mushrooms, which apparently is a tortoise delicacy. And on the other side of the V, she put one of these turtles whose name was Wilhelmina. Well, Wilhelmina knew that the food was on the other side of the V-shaped fence, but you know, where you and I might sort of walk around the fence to the other side and go and get the food, she wasn't really bright enough to figure that out. She just kept on trying to force her way through that angle in the V to try to get at the food. And eventually she gave up. Sometimes she would travel a little bit up the side of the V and then fall asleep. But she never really figured out how to do it. So what the researcher did was she taught Wilhelmina how to find the food. And it wasn't easy. It took about 150 trials for the researcher to show Wilhelmina, hey, if you walk around and go up and down into that angle in the V, you'll be able to get your food. So finally, Wilhelmina learned the trick to get the food. And once Wilhelmina had caught on, the researcher placed a few other turtles off to the side and had them watch Wilhelmina as she got her treat. And what the researcher found is once these turtles had seen Wilhelmina get the food and saw her, observed her strategy for getting the food, most of them, within only a couple trials, not the 150 trials it took Wilhelmina, were able to figure out the trick and go around the V and get the food. And this is, the researcher said, this is strong evidence for social learning in these animals because they're observing another member of their species doing something. They're learning how to do it, and then they're applying it to their own lives, just as we do as humans and as a bunch of other animal societies do.
So it sounds like social learning then isn't necessarily something that evolved only in these groups that are now social.
Well, that's the implication here. In fact, the researcher says that maybe what we're describing as social learning is just another aspect of general learning. I mean, we know most animals can learn in one way or the other. Maybe there's just nothing special about social learning. It didn't take millions of years of evolution for us and other animals to develop this. Maybe even basic animals have this ability. It's just another component of all the other types of learning they do.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, finally, Rob, speaking of social learning, I've got a scenario for you. You and I are walking down the street. Say I trip on a curb and bump into you. You're probably not going to be too angry about that. You know that was an accident.
No, sure.
But say we're walking down the street and I take a swing at your face.
Okay. All right. Well, there's something else going on.
Right. You're probably not going to be as forgiving, especially if that punch lands on your nose. And this all gets to this idea of how we morally judge another's actions. In other words, when you do something, do I know that you're doing it on purpose? Do I know that you're doing it accidentally? Are you doing it maliciously? And researchers are trying to figure out what part of the brain is responsible for this. And they've had some clues. Some studies have suggested that a region of the brain called the right temporoparietal junction is involved in how we evaluate what other people are doing, but not really specifically whether it gets into this really moral evaluation, you know, whether we sort of judge what somebody is doing is malicious or accidental. And so in this new study, researchers use this technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation. What it involves is aiming tightly focused magnetic field on certain parts of the brain. And when you do this, you can actually disable regions of the brain, at least temporarily. And so the researchers said, hey, if we disable this right temporoparietal junction, we'll be able to affect how people view other people's actions. And that's just what they saw in the study. They recruited a number of volunteers, and they had them read about scenarios like the one I just gave you. These scenarios are a little bit more violent. They had them read stories on a computer screen. In some scenarios, person A accidentally killed person B. In other scenarios, person A was actually purposely intending to kill person B, but they didn't succeed. So we're dealing with accidental death and attempted murder here. Clearly two very different moral scenarios when judged from an outside observer. And what the researchers found was that everybody was pretty forgiving of the accident. But when the researchers disabled this right temporoparietal junction in certain volunteers, those volunteers were also actually pretty forgiving of the attempted murder, suggesting that this region really does seem to be responsible for how we morally judge another person's actions.
Now, the brain is all interconnected, right? So can researchers really say by just shutting off one part, you're not also affecting 10 other parts too?
Well, one of the controls they did in the study was to actually aim this transcranial magnetic stimulation at other parts of the brain as a control. And when they did that, they didn't see an effect. So that's one piece of evidence. But when you're talking about brain regions, you're talking about a lot of gray matter. So it's hard to say. I mean, researchers say, you know, based on this, it seems like it is this region. But beyond that, if there's specific parts of the region or whether other regions might also be involved, they can't say at this point.
So say this moral evaluation is localized to this part of the brain. What implications does this have?
Well, one thing the researchers mention is Asperger's syndrome and indeed a variety of these autism spectrum disorders where researchers have shown that individuals with these disorders have a really hard time discerning other people's intentions. So while the researchers aren't going as far as to say that this particular research has any implications for therapies for these people, what they are saying is that by knowing more about what regions in the brain are responsible for how we judge another person's actions might help shed light on what specifically is going on in these disorders. And that could lead to treatments down the line.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the first motion-powered nano devices. And these are these tiny devices that you could theoretically insert inside your body or even insert inside wallpaper that just the slightest touch or the slightest breeze or even the lub-dub of your heartbeat could charge these devices and power things like blood pressure sensors or even wireless networks. So a neat little advance on the nanotechnology front. And we've also got a story about the Large Hadron Collider. That just went back up into operation earlier this week, and we've got a very nice slideshow that really takes you through the history of the collider, what's happening now, and what researchers hope to achieve in the future with the world's largest science experiment. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got an update on what some are calling ClimateGate, which involves hacked emails from climate researchers that got released to the public and how this is affecting climate policy, especially in the UK. And we've got another story about a big legal decision in the US this week about gene patents, especially on patenting genes involved in breast cancer. A judge has ruled that these patents are illegal, and we have got an item about what some of the implications of this might be for scientific research. So check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the April 2nd, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.